Accession number 23218, Rule 9.
Colonel Goodmanseth, Rule 9. You were saying that quite a lot of the troops in your northern brigade were Lapps.
Yeah, I was thinking about if we're going to find some more proxies, I would say that about 30% of the troops up there are Lapps. At that time, yeah.
Where did the other brigades come from? Were they from all over the country?
Yeah, no, the other brigades, you know, all the Norwegian brigades at that time, that was called. Combined regiment, they were called. And we had 50 more than all over the country, and that was placed in the special areas of the country. The northernest one was headquartered in Narvik, that was KR-15, combined regiment number 15. And then it was number 12 was in Trondheim, number 13 was in north of Trondheim in Steinkjer, and so on. Well, number 1 was down there in Oslo. And that organization from the army lasted for about 3 years, and then it was changed again.
What was in one of these combined regiments? Was it mainly infantry?
Three infantry battalions. Three infantry battalions, one artillery battalion, and then support troops. Engineering companies and all sorts of things.
Did that include any element of armour at that stage?
We had no armour of that type in North Norway, at that time in North Norway.
So it's purely infantry and artillery, effectively.
Yeah.
And what was the estimate of the Russian threat at that time? When you were planning the exercise, did you have any idea in your mind of what sort of scale of attack the Russians might mount if they decided to do so?
We were all the time fully aware of that, as far as strength is concerned, we had no chance whatsoever to even think of meeting them properly. That, of course, and all the movement, all the planning meant of defining places where we could, because of the country's topography and so on, could stop them.
So would this mean you were looking for bottlenecks?
Yes.
Yeah.
And of course that was, we were also very interesting to find out what chances did we have, if anything, that happened. And then of course we were very early clear that we had to be, the main defense line, be south of the advances from Finland. Of course, there is a road from Finland leading right into North Norway. And any stand knows that before, because otherwise then destroying troops and so on, and doing guerrilla warfare and so on, we had to be, the main stand had to be south of the road to Finland.
Would that then be in the area around Troms?
Yes, yeah. That's why our brigade has always been there. We still have a brigade in Troms.
And you say you knew you couldn't match the Russian strength, but did you have an idea of what that strength might be? What troop levels the Russians could actually project and sustain into that area?
I think our main thought was that was unlimited.
Unlimited.
Yeah. In compared to us.
Yeah. Now another thing that has to be considered if you're thinking about North Norway is the possibility of amphibious landings in the rear. Did you bear that in mind when you were?
That has been the main training. You know that since the NATO became organized and started off, it has been always been exercises up in this northern area, and NATO has always been taking part in those exercises, and that is one of the main things which has been tried in all the exercises, that is Allied landings on the different places.
But I mean, it's also, was there at that time an amphibious threat from the Russians? Did they have a naval infantry unit up in the Kola Peninsula as they did later?
They have, but I don't think we have not considered that as a very, very large danger, but what has been, of course, that there is always along the Norwegian coast from the north and gone down always down to about middle of Norway, there is always groups of fishing vessels operating up to 20 together in groups with one supply ship taking their catches and supplying them. And they could be a threat if they were going out as fishing vessels and then camouflage as landing vessels, what I'm not used to. Then they could land anywhere on the coast where there's no defences whatsoever.
Now, you'd been in northern Finland having a look around at the ground and so on. Were there any signs the Russians were doing the same kind of thing in North Norway at that time?
No. I don't think so. Mm. You know, the population up there is so little, and everybody, if there is anything strange coming in, everybody will know.
So you could rely on the locals to report anything like that. And another thing that's interesting is that during the Second World War, it emerged that a vital thing to have is close connection between the ground forces and air forces. Did you have an air force element involved in Exercise Blautin?
Always. Then we had also then transport squadron, fighter squadron, two fighter squadrons normally, sometimes three or four. And that was in the beginning, but all later exercises, there are airfields which are earmarked for Allied.
Rapid reinforcement.
Yeah.
Yes. What aircraft did you have at that time, at the time of Blautin?
What came after Spitfire?
Ah. Well, there was eventually a jet called the Meteor, which we used in Korea.
No, we didn't use that. The only jet we had at that time was the first one.
It was a typhoon for close air support. Hurricane, Spitfire, Typhoon, and after that I think it became Meteor, and Lightning was a jet aircraft.
I don't remember so closely what was worth. We had very few jet aircraft, or jet fighter squadrons at that time. I was saying only one squadron.
Now, another thing that occurs to me is that the Germans actually fortified that area of Norway in order to try and stop a Russian movement in, and they'd built the Lingenlinie. Did you ever consider using that as a stop line to try and stop them?
You know what we did, and you know what I did? We had all in the Italian service. So we worked very good in connection with the Americans in Wiesbaden and with the German intelligence service. I went down with a plane from the Norwegian Air Force to Wiesbaden and brought back Admiral Siljaks. He was head of the German Navy in Norway during the war. General von Teilhacker, which was in the Hitler staff, responsible for the Norway campaign, Norway area. General von Teilhacker, General Seal, another general who was seen was in German's leading staff in Oslo during the war, and it was General Nielsen, a young general, Air Force general, who had operating in North Norway. And one from organization TOT. And they were brought to Norway, and we had booked or ordered a hotel in Oslo, which was closed door for everyone else. And they stayed in Norway for 3 months, working together with people from our side, writing down their experience in fighting against the Russians in North Norway. And when they were finished, it took about 3 months, I flew them back to Frankfurt and paid them off in Frankfurt railway station.
In cash?
In cash, which we got from our consulate in Frankfurt. And that, of course, has been from the beginning of the planning of defense North Norway, which to defend Norway, which was an important NATO requirement to have that.
Mm.
That has been the main basis for the planning of defense against North Norway. Mm. And of course, they had 3 years, 4 years experience, those chaps.
Well, they must have known the ground extremely well.
Yeah, of course, yes.
What impact did joining NATO have then? And what changed once Norway became a member of North Atlantic Alliance?
Of course, we had to change all our staff system. The people had to start working on the same staff organization as was required in the NATO. And of course, that the intelligence build-up, which started in Norway that time, has been the main or the leading thing as far as defense is concerned from that time. And I'm quite sure that there is very, very few places that have been such an active intelligence service as there has been in Norway.
Mm. What about the planning process? Was that changed?
Yes, that of course, then I got the lead from what the defense plan was going to be from the requirement in the NATO. And it was also controlled and went through the machinery in NATO before it was done in Norway too. Mm. So I think that NATO has been a blessing for Norway from the start. Mm. Absolutely.
Did they make any fundamental changes in the Norwegian defensive concept that you'd based on your...
No, I don't think so. I think that has been just... of course, they had worked in the defence planning what we could expect from outside of far as help is concerned. That's why they have built up supplies in different places in Norway. And they still have it today.
Pre-positioned equipment.
Yeah.
What sort of numbers of reinforcements were you expecting to receive, and how were they planning to get into the theatre?
It's you know, there is earmarked airfields and airfield facilities and bases, naval bases and so on. You know, we have lots of naval bases which we have no use of, no need of actually. Mm. There is a big one in the mountains in Tromsø. Complete, they can take the destroyers and everything in the mountains. There is one close to Narvik, and there is one big one in Trondheim, and one in Bergen. That is three or four times more than we, of course, need.
So this is host nation support for reinforcements. What about land horses? What were you expecting in that respect?
Yeah, if we you know that we are an mobilization army. And in the time we had our training or had our service in Germany and so on, we trained one brigade. Also, we trained two brigades every year and sent them to Germany for half that time. And then every Norwegian conscript they had to go through military service. And we could mobilize 300,000 men by mobilization.
How long would that take, the process of
normally it should be done in 48 hours. Mm. And no, the new thing, what's happening now, I don't think we have more than 90,000.
Been a great reduction, that's for sure.
Yes, of course, yes.
But at that time, you were going to be mobilizing your mobilization army, but of course they would be all over the country, wouldn't they, based on population centres.
We have all the time since we started or had our main defence plan in North Norway.
Mm.
That all the groups then mobilising in South Norway have every exercise been air transported to North Norway. And if we have not had enough airplanes ourselves, we have a requisition right on one third of the SAS fleet for military purposes.
So you'd be moving troops and civilian airliners.
Yeah. You use civilian airlines and also military, of course, as far as they can do their job.
And how soon did you think you'd be expecting Allied reinforcements to arrive, ground force reinforcements?
Yeah, you know, we have had this, what we call this, advanced alarm unit in NATO, which is
spearhead unit.
Units consisting now of Germans, British, German-British.
Be the Ace Mobile Force, wouldn't it? Allied Central Europe Mobile Force. And that'd be about five battalions, I think.
And then they train in Norway every year. And so do the Royal Marine Commandos too.
Yes, you've got the Anglo-Dutch Commando as well. So you've got the Ace Mobile, you've got the Anglo-Dutch. How soon did you think that those would start beginning to arrive if
after
they were needed? To 24 hours.
Yeah, I think so, yes.
So, I mean, the main problem there, it seems to me, would be to secure their routes to get into the theatre safely.
I think that they probably get, if they, those going all the way to North Norway, could probably have difficulties. But all the others, south of Narvik and so on, I would have no difficulties to get in. No.
So they'd be all right, they'd arrive.
Yeah, I think so, yes.
What about your own naval forces? What role did they play on your exercises?
The strange thing is that's why we land army and land folk never see much of it. Is of course they have their own exercises outside the coast, where the one group play attacker and the other defender and so on. So together also the work with the Royal Navy has always been sort of day normal day handling. They're so used to working with the Royal Navy that one could believe that they belong to the same force.
What about the inshore defences, though, the sort of close coastal waters?
What is strange is that we have, since the war, built out quite a lot of modern coast defences. And the latest years, they've been also equipped with rockets. No, they're all.
So they're missile batteries, yes.
He used one missile, which is then built and constructed and so on by Kongsberg, the Penguin. That is that.
So you described this big exercise, Blautind, in the north of Norway, and you'd been to the Staff College. This must have been around about 1954-55 that you were doing these things.
Chief of Staff job in Narvik from 54 to 56. Then I came down to Norwegian Army Command as G2. And had been there for about 2 months, and then the UNIF started. And I was sitting home with my wife late on a Friday night in November. Yes, November 56. Listening to the news on the radio, and then we're told that we are putting up a unit going to Egypt, and the staff has been appointed now. They're appointed today, and they're going to be ready to go tomorrow. And then the doorbell rang. And then the chief personnel officer from Army Command came and said, "You have to be ready tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. That was Friday night.
So had you ever contemplated doing such a thing before? Had it occurred to you that this might happen?
No, I never thought of it, but you know that this was the first United Nations troops going out, you know? And I met the next morning and started to get ready with diplomatic passport and all those things needed. And I was ready to leave Norway that Saturday night by big American planes coming in here to take us with vehicles and troops and so on.
So what was your appointment then in the...
I didn't know before I got there.
So you were just flying out into the unknown?
Yes. And I met General Burns, and then he said that I was appointed G2 UNIF. And my assistant was Peter McKinnon from Canada. And we started discussing and said, what the hell should we cover this area now? And then it comes a very, very nice story. We both had been serving in the British Army during the war, and also both he and me later on. So we took contact with G2 Corps in Port Said. And they said, come up here, take a jeep and come up, we can fix this.
Where did you arrive then, when you flew into Egypt?
I was there, and we were stationed there at the beginning, I was there, and there was in Cairo. Mm. So we took a jeep and went up to the Corps in Port Said, and he was very helping. First of all, he gave us a lorry, a 3-tonner. And there he filled in the lorry all these tableaus and thing that I had had in the G2 office in the Corps. And we got order of battle of Egyptian army and the Israeli army. Every detail, where they were and not there.
What their positions as well as their order of battle.
Yes, and the organization and the names of the officers and so on.
Sounds as though the intelligence work had been very well done indeed.
Mm. And I will tell you another thing too. And then we got a book or a booklet which stated how to survive in the Sinai Desert. We were surprised. We had a very, very nice night in Cairo, in Port Said, in the headquarters of the British Corps, and went back next morning. And then General Burns asked us to, if we could give a briefing on what we had heard and got hold of in connecting with the British Army. Mm. So we put up in the intelligence room, or in the old room, operation room, complete coverage with maps and positions. And, all the thing was, we didn't take it down from as it was in court, and we took it over. The next morning, or next afternoon, they met from, of course, that time was officers from Norway, Sweden, India, Indonesia, Canada, Canada, Colombia, Finland, and Sweden. And we set it up and started off to. Given a brief of what was on the. We were just reading the tables and what was on the wall. And General Burns, he can see on it that he had figured out how this has come to. But he didn't say anything. Mm. He just got up and said that. That is the type of intelligence officer we should have had. And that book, of How to Survive in the Sinai Desert, we stayed there till 1967. Mm. That was printed and delivered to all troops when they came down, all different troops. And I thought, how to survive in the desert, in the desert, by Colonel Gudmundset and Peter McKinnon. He hadn't written a word.
And had you ever done any training for desert warfare before?
No, never been in the desert at all.
When you flew out, did you have any idea of what sort of mission you were going to?
No, I didn't know anything, otherwise that I should join the staff or unit. Mm. So, and that was very interesting. We tried to position ourselves between the Egyptian and the Israelis. And we had another very nice task too, that that's later seen in the Norwegian Army, Bull Hansen, he was there with me as a captain. And we organized the exchange of prisoners between Israel and Egypt.
How did you carry that out? Did you set up an exchange point points? No?
We organized them. After we got the papers on what was to exchange towards the Egyptian, he had six prisoners. That was the pilot who had to bail out fighting in the desert. There was one of the men, an Israeli, that caught on a ship going through the Suez Canal. Mm. And there was two soldiers who had gone the wrong way. And the Israeli had 22,000.
Something of a difference.
So we gave out one man from Israel side against five from one from Egyptian side against 5,000 from Israeli side.
Did they have to organise their own transport, or did you have to do that for them?
The Egyptian army ordered the transport.
It did. How was it? What was it like working with the Egyptian army? Did you find them cooperative, or were they difficult?
We didn't cooperate with them at all.
How strong was UNIF? You've mentioned battalions from various countries. What was the overall strength of it?
At the peak, I think there was about between 10 and 10,000.
And what were you actually supposed to do? Were you supposed to get in between the two opposing armies?
No, when we got organized, and the British withdrew, and the Israelis withdrew into Gaza. They stayed in the whole Sinai Desert to start with.
Yeah.
And we organized the retreat from there, and then in the Gaza area. We divided the Gaza area in dots for each country. Mm. And we had one of the countries which normally was the Finn, who was stationed in on the border in Egypt there before you got into the Sinai to look after supplies and to guard the canal, the Suez Canal. Of course, there was a lot of smuggling from narcotica going on still at that time.
Mm. So was that within your brief to try and stop smuggling?
Yes. The Finns did that.
What were your main activities then once you got organised? Were you in static posts or were you out patrolling?
Yeah, observation posts all over the area. So that was to stop the illegal movement between different areas.
Were there a lot of attempts at illegal movement?
Yes, of course, but I think that nobody has so much experience in working with Arabs and other type than British army, the British have. So that was the time down there, yes.
What were you doing day by day in your job on the staff at UNIF? What were your...
We were then giving out a weekly briefing of intelligence news. That was more or less our daily work. And that got less and less because it was more or less stabilized all over the place.
Nothing going on then?
Nothing going on then, mostly.
And where did you get your information for that intelligence? Did it come from your own observation posts?
Yeah, from our own posts and what's happening there. And we still kept a connection with British Corps in Cyprus.
Yes.
And he also told us, you know, when we left with the lorry with all in the we got there, he said, hey, is there anything you need, maps or so? Just give me a note, and then he sent them. He sent the maps of all the places. We couldn't find them on the map. And I suppose the gypsum had something, but...
What would an observation post consist of, and how would it be manned?
We were building observation tower. And normally there was always two on guard in the towers. And they was changed every 4 hours.
How high would a tower be, and what would it be made of?
Made of wood. I would say 6 to 10 meters high.
Yeah. So to give you could see quite a lot of ground.
Yes.
How what would the distance between towers be? Would they be within sight of each other, or?
In difficult areas, in the northern Gaza Strip area, But in southern, no.
Did you have mobile patrols as well as these static posts?
Yeah, along the border there were roads, but quite a lot there were no roads whatsoever.
What would a mobile patrol be?
It'd be four men in a jeep. That's all we think we could do there.
Did you detect any attempt by either side to violate the ceasefire terms by infiltration or by other?
No, we had some difficulties with at that time we had Indonesian troops and guard in southern part of Gaza Strip where we had all our supplies, and there were a lot of stealing by night from the different places And you know, there is no such a good thief as the Egyptians.